BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word. BCFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Billions of public money stolen on MOD contract fraud while essential public services close, but the MOD police just turn a blind eye. Bristol is the base for the Ministry of Defence procurement offices, but as one former defence contractor employee tells tonight, fraud has become systematic. Billions of pounds of public money going into contractors' pockets for doing nothing. And the people who are supposed to be stopping it and told it's too embarrassing to prosecute, that is the Ministry of Defence Police, also doing nothing. This week, former defence industry software engineer Robert McCartney spills the beans on MOD procurement and asks, when will the billions of our money used for corporate criminal welfare, meaning our troops' equipment is either late or doesn't arrive at all, be stopped? Plus, can we have economic growth whilst also protecting the environment? Destroying forests all looks good on the scale of GNP, so do we really need growth? And has it gone past the limit where we can have both growth and a decent environment? David Powell is here from Friends of the Earth. Hi, David, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
Now, first of all, tell us what your role is at Friends of the Earth.
Well, I do a wide range of stuff, really, Tony, but mostly at the moment I'm looking at two things. I'm looking at the economics of energy bills. So there's a lot of stuff out there about green taxes, people worried about their energy bills going up. And the real reason for that is fossil fuels and the fact that we're completely structurally addicted to them. So we're doing a lot of work around that at the moment. But I'm also looking at this bigger picture stuff that you talked about. So what sort of economy do we want to have to look after people and the planet? How do we get an economy functioning within the limits that the planet gives us? We can't have infinite growth within a finite planet, so how do we deal with that?
Okay, well, let's start with the first point, which is the energy bills. I think this is where we're honestly, you know, many people, this is the coal face for, you know, the money and the environment, and we want to know, why is it, I mean, for example, today we've got EDF Energy in the news, having basically been going around, you know, not actually physically mugging people, but conning them at the doorsteps.
Yeah, well, there's two big things that have been pushing energy bills up, and over the last decade, and people will know, you use the word coalface, this is where, you know, people are hurting. Across the country, there's millions of people in what's called fuel poverty, which means they can't afford to pay their bills and put food on the table, or at least they struggle to do that. Now, what's caused bills to go up is two things. It's the price of the fuel, so the price of the gas and the coal upon which our electricity and gas system is based, but also it's profits of the big six energy companies. So much anger out there at the moment at the big six energy companies. As people's bills have been getting more expensive in the last couple of years, so are the profits of the big six energy companies. You've seen all the stuff in the news. British Gas comes out with a profit increase. Centrica comes out with a profit increase. EDF comes out. And not only are these guys making huge amounts of money at the same time that people are struggling to heat their homes properly, but as you've seen in the news today, you know, they're up to some pretty dodgy stuff as well. So what we want to see is an alternative. We want to see a better way of powering our energy system, and we want to see people demanding that they can have control of their energy system and clean, secure energy.
Well, just to recap on that story, EDF, the energy provider EDF, has agreed to pay a package imposed by the regulator Ofgem, which amounts to a fine of £4.5 million today. Ofgem found that EDF sales staff made misleading claims to customers. The regulator said the company's doorstep staff failed to provide potential customers with complete information during the sales process, while those in its call centres made claims about savings before knowing whether or not their statements were true. Now, it does sound to me like the sort of privatisation, deregulation of this industry is leading now to some, you know, what is actually not fair competition, but unfair competition.
That's absolutely spot on, Tony. Yeah, so what we've got, in a way, I've got this idea for a blog for work that I keep kicking around. I've never got around to writing it, about the similarities between Chelsea Football Club and the Big Six. Now, what you've got here is a chronic problem of short-termism. We need investment. But because everyone's pursuing profits, because everybody's just worried about the here and now, and because we have got this privatised market, nobody's been putting in place the big investment that we need to see so that we can have renewables, so that we can make our power cleaner and fairer. And instead, you've just got profit-seeking and more pressure to put bills up, and that's where that's coming from.
Now, is anything going to happen with my big bugbear, which is this whole thing, which is a sort of insiders call confusion marketing, where you're marketing various different packages, energy packages to the consumers, but it's impossible for people to directly compare one with another. So you may be getting a package which is cheaper at night time by a few pounds a month or a few pounds a week, but it's actually more expensive in the daytime. So you're sitting there scratching your head and saying, well, I don't actually know. I can't directly compare one with another. And of course, for the consumer, that's no good. That's not competition if you can't compare one product with another.
Yeah, absolutely. And now, David Cameron, to be fair to him, he sat down with the energy companies end of last year and he said, look, this is ridiculous, all of these tariffs that are out there. I think there's something like 400 different variations of tariffs that you can get across the different energy companies. Apparently, people can save up to £200 or £300 a year just by making sure they were on the best tariff for them. But how on earth they're supposed to find out about that, I don't know. Now, energy companies are supposed to be writing to everyone over the next few months. You might have had a letter already advising them that, you know, you can change energy company, that's an easy thing to do, and they're supposed to be putting on the bottom of all their bills words to the effect of, did you know if you change tariff you could save some money? I think it's still a very confusing thing for people to deal with, and ultimately what people want is not to have to wrestle with different tariffs. They want clean and simple choices. They want to know where they get their power from, how much it's going to cost them, what's best for them, and they want some sort of understanding that the investments that's being made, that's putting up their bill, is actually good for the long term and not just going into big companies' profits.
Martin, there's certain indications that the privatisation of the energy market hasn't really worked for consumers. Is there any prospect of it being retaken over, maybe electricity generation and distribution, the national grid network, this kind of thing, by the Department of Energy and by a central administration, particularly with this news today that EDF has been fined so much money simply for basically misleading people?
Well, I think the privatisation of the electricity industry and the gas industry in the 1980s was completely misconceived, and we're now reaping the whirlwind of that misconception. You can't really have a competitive market in an oligopolistic structure like this. That's why these industries were nationalised in the first place, because that's what you do when you've got an oligopolistic structure where people profiteer. You nationalise it, and then you can sell. If you've got a nationalised electricity industry, you can sell at marginal cost to whoever your customers are, because you're not there to make a profit. And then, of course, that means that your small businesses get a cost advantage, a competitive advantage dealing with the outside world. So what we've got in Britain is profiteering on the basic infrastructure, and that actually puts the cost up for people trying to export into the international market. And of course, it makes money for some, but it was always in defiance of the economics textbook that I was taught. But of course, we get used to this in Britain. We've been running lots of things in defiance of the economics textbook since the Thatcher era, and we still wonder why it doesn't work.
Well, yeah, and I think the great myth that was put around 20 years ago when privatisation was first kicked around is that this will bring prices down, you know, and as people have seen, bills over the last 10 years have gone up, and they've gone up because ultimately, no matter what sort of market you've got, the big factors that are affecting supply and demand are international, you know, so we depend on what the price that coal is sold for internationally, that gas is sold for internationally. Now our supplies of all that stuff is running out, and the more we're reliant on that stuff, the more bills are going to go up and up and up and up, which is why we say that taking advantage of the fantastic renewable resource that we've got in this country, it'll cost a bit more to build the things, but in the long run, that's the way to go, to get clean, secure energy so that we can stop this volatility in bills, which is really hitting people hard.
Well, Martin, what we're hearing here is that it's international energy prices that are going up, so it wouldn't make any difference if it had been privatised or nationalised.
Well, I mean, the what determines the international energy price? I mean, these are all substitutes, so oil has to be counted in what we're talking about here. The oil price is driven up by geopolitical manipulation and by the deregulation of the futures market in 2000 in the US.
But
virtually all of the price, cost of a barrel of oil is speculative froth.
But Martin, Are you saying that the oil isn't running out then?
No, the oil is running out, but we've got on top of the oil running out, we've also got speculators being given a free ride by the deregulation of the commodities futures market. You used to be only able to take positions in the commodities futures market to a very limited extent, and it was just hedging against small changes. But Wall Street pushed for a complete deregulation, and now, of course, bubbles can be blown. You just keep chucking money at it, and the price keeps rising, and as long as it keeps rising, it can carry on rising. So what we've got, a lot of the quantitative easing money has gone into the commodity futures market in oil and food, so we've now got a situation where the quantitative easing to rescue the banks has been chucked at the commodity markets, pushing up the price of oil and food, which is the most basic commodities for most people on the planet, and then sparking revolutions in places like Egypt and Tunisia, and it's still the whole system is utterly dysfunctional.
It would cost $64 billion, it's been estimated. A report came out from a new campaign called the Energy Pearl Revolution. For $64 billion, you could insulate every single home in this country that currently needs to be insulated so that their bills would come tumbling down. That is something like one-fifth of the total amount of money that's been chucked into quantitative easing that's disappeared into the banks. They've either used it to build up their bank reserves or they've used it to speculate and hedge and build commodity prices up. It's exactly the sort of thing where the wrong solution is being...
Or, just one other thing I'd like to add to that, or... lobby the government, because they use our money to lobby, for themselves.
Milton Friedman pointed this out many years ago. Once the government becomes a milch cow, you've got an infrastructure which then demands more. And this is actually exactly how the banks and the energy industry operates. It's a charmed circle, isn't it?
David, you've talked a bit about what Friends of the Earth is doing to lobby the government, ideas it's putting to the government. But what is Friends of the Earth, through its publications and various other things, what are you advising your members to do about, you know, actually bringing their bills down and making sure that the money they do spend on energy is going into sensible energy, which is less polluting and also maybe less corrupt? That is to say, possibly not to EDF, who have had to pay this massive fine today.
Well, we've been leading the campaign for the government not to pull the rug out from under the feet of the boom in solar panels that we've got, particularly in this part of the world. Actually, the street that I live on is extraordinary, the amount of solar panels on there. Now, at the moment, people can get a subsidy to put a solar panel on their roof, and the government has completely mismanaged it, doesn't like solar panels very much anyway, and last December tried illegally to cut the subsidy prematurely. We took them to court, and we won twice, and the government are still appealing because they're just desperate to stop people putting these solar panels in because they think they're getting too much subsidy. If you generate your own power, and you can do it right now, you can either, if you can afford to do it, put the panel on your roof yourself, or you can do it in a community group as part of a social housing scheme, or you can use what's called a rent-a-roof scheme where a company will give you the panel and then charge you in the longer run. You can generate your own power. You don't have to get stuff from the big six energy companies. If you combine that with some sensible insulation, like some pretty cheap loft insulation, some cavity wall insulation, and taking advantage of loans and grants that you can get, you can bring your bills down. And that's what everybody has the power to do. But also they do need the right mechanisms to do it. And the thing that we always say is that individual action is fantastic, but make sure your politicians hear about how important this is to you. Make sure your MP hears about it. Make sure they know how much your energy bills are hurting you, and you want a different approach than the one we've got right now.
So, yes, we've heard a bit also about what you've been doing to lobby. Have you been in any way successful? Obviously, in this last case, no, because you're in the courts fighting the government. But have the government been listening at all over the last 18 months or so since they were elected?
Oh, well, the court case has actually been fantastically successful. So we were challenging primarily on a point of principle. Now, what was going on was that solar panels were essentially, the subsidies were too high, because the cost of solar panels have come tumbling down because they're taking off all over the world. So we didn't have any problem with the idea of paying a bit less subsidy to people. What the government were trying to do was, in a space of about 6 weeks, completely slash the subsidy that was available. And that's not really good news if you've got an investment in train, if you're thinking about doing it, if you're a social housing scheme that's already bought the panels and can't afford to put them on. So we were challenging that principle. Now, we won that twice in the courts. The government has appealed to the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, about this, because they don't want that verdict to stand. Not because of the financial implications. This isn't about the money. This is about whether or not the government has the right to mess around with a promise that it's made to people about a subsidy that they will get. And I think even if the Supreme Court were to take this case, which they haven't said they've done, and even if they were to take it and find against us, which I think our advisors have said is pretty unlikely, even if all that happens, I think the sheer outrage that's been caused, the lobbies of Westminster, the huge amounts of representation from the solar industry and beyond, the amount of jobs that would have been lost, I think the government has got the message. And you're seeing they've got the message because they've actually turned around now and said, OK, we get it. People like solar. Let's have 20 times as much of it in the next 10 years. And the debate now is around what level of subsidy you use to get that, not whether we should have it. So I think we have made huge advances in the area.
Now, there was a big announcement yesterday to do with rail fares. And I know you're also looking at the fuel duty that goes on the railways. But Sir Roy McNulty's rail value for money study came out yesterday. It's now allowing, in the future, it looks as if it will allow the train companies to start charging what they want. Because, I mean, he's actually originally from the aviation business. He was the chief executive of Short Brothers, who were a Northern Ireland firm that made aircraft. And then he went on to become the chairman of the Civil Aviation Authority. And he's on the vice chair of the Olympic Delivery Committee. He's on the board of the privatised Gatwick Airport. He's a very busy man. But amazingly enough, he found time to come up with a very thoughtful report into completely deregulating rail fares. What are your thoughts about what he's come up with? Because, I mean, he wasn't very successful, for example, when he was at Short Brothers. The company basically was run into the ground and then got taken over. I mean, is he the right guy to be doing this kind of report?
I don't want to say too much about him as a bloke, primarily because I don't know too much about him as a bloke. What I do know about is the stuff that has been in the news yesterday and what the government is proposing to do, and it's pretty alarming, to be honest, Tony. Now, the headline thing that they want to do is to allow train companies to increase even more than they already are the cost of train fares at the busiest parts of the day. I live out in North Somerset. I come in on the train sometimes, I get my bike sometimes. It's £8 a day if I get a single in the morning, a single in the evening, £5 a day if I don't. I don't have a huge amount of choice about when I travel, and most people that travel to work don't. The government's response to this is to encourage employers to let people come in later. I thought it was fantastic that the Transport Secretary was asked whether she would let her employees at the DFT come in a bit later to avoid the peak train fares, and she didn't have a very good response to that. But it goes back to something Martin was talking about earlier, which is actually the illusion of competition here. Now, what you've got is incredibly close privatisation at the same sort of time as the energy companies. And there is no competition on the railways at all. At least with your energy company, you can change energy company, even if you don't get a much better deal when you do. With the railways, if you want to travel from, say, Edinburgh to London, you've got one option, basically, whether you get the train, and you are pretty much, unless you have a car or you want to fly, you are pretty much in hoc to that train company. Prices are going up and up and up. The price of travelling by rail has gone up by 24% in real terms. Obviously, if you add inflation onto that, it's significantly more. Over the last decade, over the period that Labour was in power. Over that period, the whole price of motoring, the price of travelling by car, if you include buying a car, servicing it, insuring it, came down in real terms. It's getting more and more and more expensive to travel by rail, and the answer to that is not to allow fares to become even more expensive. The answer to that is to say, what sort of rail system do we want to have?
Well, one wonders whether maybe the oil companies are just telling the government what to do, because it all seems to be driving people into their cars. Martin, what's your thoughts about this whole vision of railways? So I've got a couple of figures for you here, which I dug out from a really good article on the Independent website from last year by Ben Chu at the Independent, which is that 20 years ago, before the railways were privatised, this is the beginning of the 90s, the subsidy to the railways was £1.5 billion. It's now £4.5 billion. Now, obviously, there's changes with inflation, but whereas before privatisation we were subsidising 10% of the cost of the railways, we're now subsidising 20%.
Well, it just says it all, doesn't it? It's the economics of the madhouse. What I would say, and I would make this case, and we've got to start making it again, because it hasn't been properly for a generation, there is a case for having a plan. The market is not the answer to everything. If you've got a hammer in your hand, every problem looks like a nail. Now, in actual fact, during World War II, we had to have a plan for our energy, because it was all about the Atlantic convoys and all the rest of it. And coming out of that war, people realise, if you're going to do anything, you've got to have a long-term plan, and the market conforms to your plan. Now, I know this sounds like heresy. I know it sounds absolutely crazy. But you know what? The market has failed, and we're going to have to go back to planning. And one of the things we should be planning, for example, is to reduce our energy consumption, not worry about where we're going to get more energy from. Amory Lovins from the Rocky Mountain Institute, I circulated one of his pamphlets around Eastern Europe many years ago, and he said the obvious solution to all of this is retrofit everything to be super efficient and design the new stuff to be super efficient. When you build a house in Germany, it's got to have zero emissions. And of course, if you make that the regulation, then that's the sort of stuff you get. And then over the medium term, you save yourself a fortune. And that's because you've got a plan. The Conservatives in particular, and New Labour as well, were obsessed with this idea that competition markets, competition markets. You say, well, have you read the textbook about competition and markets? They're imperfect. And the big markets where you've got big infrastructure involved, they're even more imperfect. Now, you sometimes talk to these sort of right-wing politicians and say, imperfect markets, can they be? It's like, yes, that's the real world. And that's what you've got to do, is work within the imperfect real world and be a bit smart about it.
Well, absolutely. And we were talking earlier about the energy companies, and I think it was really significant last year that the government had actually said, wait a minute, look, we accept that the liberalised energy market is not delivering for any number of these things, for cheap bills, for reducing carbon emissions, for energy security in the future. And and look what happened with the railways, with the renationalisation of Network Rail track, as it was. The system wasn't working. It was an experiment. Now, there is place for competition, but absolutely it's got to be within the right rules.
We're not going to close down St Nick's Market, but this isn't St Nick's Market, is it?
I was going to suggest the place for competition on the railways is tendering to provide a buffet service on the platform. You know, that's about as far as it needs to go. Mm. But anyway, back, David, to my original question, I suppose, which was, is the idea of economic growth actually opposed to looking after the environment?
It's a difficult one, isn't it? I think there has been a huge amount of debate around this. We've got, on the one hand, the very clear situation, which is that for as long as economic growth is a factor of material usage, for as long as it's a factor of stuff, for as long as it's a factor of carbon emissions, for as long as getting richer means we use more stuff, we've got a problem because we haven't got that much stuff. I'm not just talking we in the Western sense. We've got 7 billion people now, huge chunks of which are industrialising very quickly. There isn't enough stuff on the world. There isn't enough carbon space in the atmosphere for everyone to live like America or Europe does.
But can't we factor in some of these more fictitious apparent GMP, which is things like these derivatives markets, where you're talking about kind of bonds and insurance policies apparently generating massive amounts of GMP? Do you, at Friends of the Earth, are you actually able to separate those out and look at them separately?
Well, I think
rather than from real stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're looking at GDP, which is the thing that's always held up, it's the thing politicians promise to increase and the things that politicians get kicked out for not increasing. GDP is pretty useful as a measure of one thing only, which is just how much stuff is going on in the economy. As any sort of measure of progress, if I would argue economic, certainly social, environmental progress, is completely unhelpful. Not only does it not measure things like the work that people do for free, it probably doesn't measure an awful lot of what goes on at this radio station, Tony, for a start. It doesn't measure the work that people do in the home, but also if your house burns down and you have to pay to replace everything in it, well, that's good for GDP, but it's not particularly good for you.
Martin, what are your thoughts? Also, I would like to just get the terminology right. I mean, so I'm talking about GMP, gross national product, gross domestic product. What's the difference?
Gross national product takes account of, what is it, imports and exports or capital transfers or something. GDP is the raw thing.
Come on, I thought that this would be easy for you, Martin.
No, I used to teach this, but I'm just trying to dredge it up. I mean, GNP is the more refined figure, in fact. GDP is the rough figure.
There's not a huge amount of difference.
There's not a huge amount of difference. That's why people often use them interchangeably. I used to have to drill my students into what was in GNP and what was not in GDP. But
let's not worry about that for a second. There's a first.
Like
there.
A tree in a.
So what about this idea of the environment versus the GDP?
Well, I think there's been an awful lot of debate about this. I think what people have got to understand is that growth doesn't have to mean more stuff. If we get the right kind of growth, we get more, what we want is dynamism and more sophistication in our economy going forward, so that you ultimately get the same outputs for much less inputs.
Okay, I've just got an answer for you online here. Yeah. Gross domestic product is not to be confused with GNP, gross national product, which allocates production based on ownership. Gross domestic product is related to national accounts, a subject in macroeconomics.
So that's clear as mud, actually.
Well, no, I mean, what they're saying is national accounts, so they're looking at the government accounts, whereas...
Yeah, well, there are different ways of calculating GNP and GDP. There's either, you either calculate what everybody's paid out or what everybody's paid. Yeah. There's I thought that was true of both of them. I mean, all of these techniques for managing the economy were developed in the 30s. I mean, the people didn't have GNP or GDP figures before the Keynesian revolution, if you like, and of course war. That made the government really wanted to know what was going on, so they needed some stats to tell them.
Okay, I've got a better definition here. Yeah. GDP can be contrasted with gross national product, GNP, or gross national income. The difference is that GDP defines its scope according to location, whereas GNP defines its scope according to ownership.
So in other words, foreign money coming in. So the City of London gets loads of money coming in. That's not counted in GDP, but it's counted in GNP. Yeah.
But it's still, in terms of what the essential thing that it's counting, it's still the same thing. It's still counting, if you like, economic activity. It's still not. It's no different approaching any of these problems about is all economic activity a good thing? Is all economic activity?
The question is, it's the quality of the economic activity. Exactly. What you're looking for is economies of scope, not just economies of scale. So the most successful economies are actually reducing their energy consumption even as they're improving living standards, and that's got to be the goal, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on at the moment, which it'd be really interesting to see where it goes, about measuring well-being. So I think people have seen the financial crisis. They've seen the limits of pursuing economic growth. And if you meet your mates down the pub and you ask them how they're going, it's very rare that they'll say, oh, well, you know, I'm great, but the economy's not so good. What really matters to people is how they're doing in their personal lives. It's their own job, it's their own security, it's their own health and how their kids are doing and things like that. So the Office for National Statistics are halfway through this pretty impressive exercise, actually, to try to come up with a way to measure well-being. And that uses real things. It's not just woolly stuff like how are you feeling, although there is some of that in there. It does try to get a composite measure of people's jobs and people's health and life expectancy and what their environment is like and all of that sort of thing. So that's come from David Cameron, that's come from Nicolas Sarkozy, it's come from Stiglitz, it's come from this sort of feeling, I think, that there has to be some better way of doing it. Now, I think it's a very useful start. The reason why I'm a little bit not sure about it is because I don't think it's going to stop David Cameron going out and saying, vote for me, I will deliver more GDP. And that's really the problem we've got.
Or anybody else.
Or indeed anyone else. And it won't stop the media writing about it, and it won't stop people voting on the basis of that. So
Maybe they're hedging their bets, thinking, well, if we are into a long-term recession here, we better find another way of measuring everything which counts well-being or something. Anyway, David, just to round up, can you just give us an idea of Friends of the Earth's activities in and around Bristol and how people can get your publications, get on, join as members, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, the best thing to do is to probably nip online and have a look for Bristol Friends of the Earth, a very active local campaigning branch of Friends of the Earth. We're a national organisation, but we've also got 230 local groups all over the country, and it's a fantastic Bristol group here. You've also got North Somerset Friends of the Earth and surrounding areas like that. Pick up the phone, dial 0207 490 1555. You'll get through to our switchboard. They'll put you through to whoever you want to speak to.
And how much, what's the bottom line? How much does it cost to join? If you want to increase your GDP by a few pounds a year, how do you join Friends of the Earth?
Well, the most useful thing for Friends of the Earth, actually, is for people to come on board and do whatever they're comfortable with doing. If you want to give us some money, you can give us some money. That's absolutely fine. But what we really need is for everyone to start lobbying their politicians, doing the actions, getting involved in their local community, finding out more, making a difference in that way.
But you have a magazine, don't you, which can, you know, that's the way to sort of, I suppose, to catch up with what's going on and what you need to be bending your MP's ear about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so you get that. I think if you give us, it's not a huge amount, and it's different amounts for the unwaged, different amounts for the unemployed, don't have the number at the top of my head, but the Friends of the Earth website at www.foe.co.uk, it's got all of that stuff on there. You'll get our free magazine as part, well, it's not free, it's part of the membership, but you'll get that as part of your membership. You'll also get a huge amount, you'll get hooked into what's going on in your local area, you'll get all the support you need, and you'll get to find out how you can make a difference. That's really good stuff.
David Powell from Friends of the Earth, South West Friends of the Earth, and London Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Dave.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Bristol is the base for the Ministry of Defence procurement offices, but as one former defence contractor employee tells, fraud has become systematic. Billions of pounds of public money going into contractors' pockets for doing nothing. And the people who are supposed to be stopping it, that's the MOD Fraud Squad police, are told it's too embarrassing to prosecute. This week, former defence industry software engineer Robert McCartney spills the beans on the MOD procurement fraud and asks, when will the billions of our money used for corporate criminal welfare, and also meaning our troops' equipment is either late or doesn't arrive at all, be stopped?
My name's Robert McCartney.
I was a software engineer, mainly in the defence industry, defence and aerospace, for about 20 years. As far as I know, I'm the only person who's ever reported fraud on an MOD equipment contract and then subsequently got another job in the defence industry and reported more fraud. Based on my experience and the public available information, it seems clear that this type of fraud is extremely common and that it's costing British taxpayers astronomical sums of money. It seems to be damaging the armed forces, and I think it's even putting national security at risk, really. The police force which deals with allegations of fraud on MOD equipment contracts is the MOD Police Fraud Squad, and that is controlled by the MOD, unfortunately. And every time somebody reports a fraud on an MOD equipment contract, the MOD carries out a cover-up.
So can you give us the nuts and bolts? How does this fraud work?
Well, I've come across several different types of fraud. If I can concentrate on just one, that would be overcharging for changes on the equipment specification. Now, when I came into the industry in 1979, it was repeatedly hammered into me that you should never change the contract specification unless you absolutely have to, because it leads to enormous delays, enormous increase in costs, ultimately less reliable equipment. And also, even before I came in March 1978, the MOD issued an internal training document which remained current up until a couple of years ago. That document, DEFCON Guide Number 5, said that changes to the contract specification should be kept to a minimum because otherwise it became impossible to compare the cost of the contract with what was originally agreed. So when I came in, everybody agreed you shouldn't change the contract specification unless you have to. And yet during my time, it became common for the cost of contracts to double or triple because of changes to contract specifications. That was because they introduced a system where there was competitive tendering for contracts, or there was supposed to be. So companies would try and keep the price down for their initial bid, but then they would use the changes to the contract specification where there was no competition element involved, and they would overcharge for those changes in order to push up the price and get the level of profit they wanted. And in fact, in January 2004, Admiral Sir Raymond Lygo, the former CEO of British Aerospace, which has since changed its name to BAE Systems, and which is our largest defence contractor, in January 2004, he gave an interview to BBC Radio 5, in which he said that British Aerospace, as it was when he was in charge, routinely did this. What the BBC didn't mention was that this scheme can't work unless you use false invoices, which because of the MP's expense scandal, we now know is a criminal offence.
Now, the MOD police, you would think, would pick up on this.
In the year 2000, I allowed my name to be used in an article that was published by The Observer about fraud carried out by a company which had been acquired by BAE Systems. I was the named source, and as a result of that article, the MOD police were forced to carry out a criminal investigation. But they only spoke to me a couple of times, you know, just for a few hours. And they went off then for 18 months dealing with MOD civil servants and so on. At the end of that time, they came back to me and said, "We found no evidence of fraud at all." But it was clear from what they said that MOD civil servants had deliberately lied to them. And any attempt to mislead a criminal investigation is itself a serious criminal offence. When I pointed this out to the MOD police, they said, "Well, we don't care. We work for the MOD. We're part of the MOD. And as long as they're happy, that's all we care about." And that I dealt with about 9 different MOD police officers. And they all seemed to have this attitude, you know, "We're not here to uphold the law, we're just here to do whatever the MOD want us to do." Whatever organisation or organisations are responsible for investigating allegations of fraud have to be, number one, organisationally independent from the MOD, and they have to be independent not just organisationally, but independent in thought. because when Surrey Police, for instance, were investigating the deep cut deaths, one case was where a guy was supposed to have shot himself in the head twice, which an independent expert employed by the family said was completely impossible. Anyway, when Surrey Police were investigating those deaths, a subsequent inquiry, I think by the Cornwall Police, found they had just had this attitude that these people who were talking to us from the Army and the MOD, these are important people. So whatever they're saying must be true. It doesn't matter what any evidence or whatever anybody else says. What these important people say must be true. So that's the second thing. They must be independent in mind. And thirdly, they've got to have the resources to do the job properly. When I tried to get other police forces involved in this, after I'd, you know, become convinced that the MOD police would never do anything, I just couldn't manage it. The last time I tried this, I went to Lothian and Borders, I think it was, police, and the guy, I said, look, you can check this information. This is available publicly, you know. It's easy to check. Just to convince you that what I'm saying is true. And after a couple of weeks, he came back to me and said, yeah, I've checked it, and as far as I can see, everything you say is correct, but I'm not going to stick my neck out, so I'm going to refer all this back to the MOD police, which in effect killed off any possibility of a genuine independent criminal investigation.
Now, you mentioned that you knew of several specific types of fraud. Can you talk about the others?
Well, another one is where you get money in for one contract and then you spend it on a completely different contract. I also reported that in 2000. Contracts where I've seen this sort of thing happen. I've worked mainly on radar, sonar, communications command and control systems, tactical data handling systems, things like that. And I've seen this happen where on submarine contracts, on aircraft radar contracts, where one contract where I saw this happening, the company had two contracts for similar but different submarine systems. One of those was a cost-plus contract, which is where no matter how much money the company spends, they're guaranteed a certain level of profit. And the other one was what's called a fixed-price contract, although there are various different types of fixed-price contract. What they were doing was they were getting people who were working on the fixed-price work to book to the cost-plus contract. Even though they were doing work for the fixed price contract, they were booking it to the cost plus contract. And this was regarded as nothing exceptional. You know, they filled out false timesheets, but if you looked at the weekly reports, they said what they were really doing, which was completely different from what they were booking to. Those cost plus contracts were supposed to be phased out in the early 80s. It was one of the very few things the Thatcher government did, which I thought was right. But those contracts ran for an awful long time, so it went on for a long time. And the other thing you see is, I've mentioned changes to contract specifications. Each change constitutes a separate cost-plus contract. So those contracts have continued to be given out because if a company is working on a project, which is likely to go on for 10 years or something, it's just totally impractical to get some other company to tender for the contract to introduce a change to the specification. So those have to be cost plus. And as I say, if the cost of a contract triples because of specification changes, then two-thirds of the cost of the contract is made up of cost plus contracts.
Another type of fraud that you've come across?
I presented an internal memo to the MOD police about this. Under Michael Heseltine, the government introduced a levy on exports of equipment which had been developed with money from the British government. So if the British government paid for all the development costs and the company didn't incur any risks in developing this stuff, then if they export it to another customer, they have to get permission from the British government, and they also have to pay a very small levy on the profit they make from exporting it to this other customer. In this case, the company were pretending that they developed something with their own money, when in fact they were developing it entirely from the money provided by the MOD. So they were avoiding paying the export levy.
So have the Ministry of Defence Fraud Squad ever actually prosecuted?
As far as I know, there have been very, very few cases where they have prosecuted. In terms of developing equipment for the army rather than in land deals or else. I only know of two cases. Was it in November 1988? Dale Campbell Savers, who was a member of the Public Accounts Committee, said that the Director of Public Prosecutions would not allow any prosecutions of defence companies which had overseas arms contracts, because prosecuting them in Britain for fraud would damage their reputation and damage arms exports. And he's come forward with several fraud cases where somewhere he thought there was prima facie evidence of major fraud. And he is a QC. And he said the only cases where there had been prosecutions were of companies that have actually gone out of business. In March 1988, Dale Campbell Savers, he was a Labour member of the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee. He accused Marconi Command and Control Systems of overcharging for changes to the specification for a system called BATES, which is Battlefield Artillery Target Engagement System. And the immediate response of the MOD was to say, we can't comment on this because we're renegotiating that contract. And they continued to use this excuse for almost a decade, right up until the Conservatives left power. As soon as they left power, apparently negotiations were then completed and the Labour Party came in and they answered a question about this. But just a couple of months before the Conservatives left power, I persuaded David Wigley, the leader of Plaid Cymru, to ask a question about the cost of BATES. And the answer he got from the government minister concerned was, I can't answer this because negotiations are still continuing. This was 4 years after the government had announced that it was going to accept the BATES contract and it was going to pay £300 million for it. And it was originally only supposed to cost £100 million. It's quite clear to me, at any rate, and I hope to everybody else, that they were just using this as an excuse. I mean, if they'd agreed they were going to accept it, they'd agreed the price, what was left to negotiate? They probably left something very minor open as an excuse for refusing to answer questions. And the thing is, the government minister who was, as I see it, involved in that cover-up, was James R. Buthnot, who is the current chairman of the House of Commons Defence Committee, which is supposed to provide oversight of the MOD. I reckon that guy is totally unfit for that position, and I even think there ought to be a criminal investigation to see if he can be prosecuted for his part in that cover-up.
Well, the Defence Committee is one committee. The Public Accounts Committee traditionally is supposed to have a really good look at this, basically like to audit this spending. Is it actually able to effectively do that?
If you listen to the news, it sounds like under Margaret Hodge, their current chairman, they are actually having some effect. The level of overspend due to changes in specifications this year, I believe, is down to £500 million, which is still a hell of a lot of money, but a lot less than it used to be. But on the other hand, you see, I think the MOD are able to give out a lot of very misleading information. The MPs themselves probably rely heavily on National Audit Office reports. And as I say, based on my examination of just one report, I've really got no confidence in the National Audit Office at all. See, the thing is, they get all their information from the Ministry of Defence. As to how the system actually works, I do remember Ken Livingstone saying when he was an MP, he tried to get on the Defence Committee, and he said, you can't. Only people who have links to the defence industry can get on the Defence Committee. You know, sometimes I think I am going to get somewhere, but I've been very, very disappointed. I mean, for instance, back in 2000, as part of the deal for allowing my name to be published in The Observer, Anthony Barnett, who was writing that piece, introduced me to a senior person in the Liberal Democrat Party. That was Greg Simpson, the Liberal Democrat Foreign Affairs and Defence Advisor. And he promised me that the Liberal Democrats would back me 100% in trying to put an end to this fraud. And this was a pledge that was repeated by his immediate successor. But I'm afraid after that, it just fell off their agenda. In reality, they actually never did anything. And now they're in government. Nick Harvey is the Liberal Democrat Minister for Defence Procurement. It's his department. And the most charitable thing I can say about him is he's a complete waste of space. I mean, he automatically accepts whatever his civil servants say to him without question, even though I can prove they've been lying for a quarter of a century.
Is the this kind of fraud that you've talked about, these various different types of fraud, likely to affect the effectiveness of the troops and also their safety?
I've mentioned Admiral Sir Raymond Lygo saying, in effect, that profits at BAE Systems depended on getting changes to the specification and overcharging for them. Now, just 2 years after he said that, a Nimrod aircraft exploded in mid-air over Afghanistan, killing 14 service personnel. In the official inquiry into that, Sir Charles Haddon Cave said that if the newer Nimrod aircraft, the replacement MRA-4 aircraft, had been delivered on time, that accident wouldn't have happened and those 14 people wouldn't have been killed. And the reason why the MRA-4s were not delivered on time was because there had been so many changes to the contract specification. Remember, I said that when I came into the industry, everyone agreed you shouldn't change it unless you absolutely have to. But there had been so many changes on the MRA-4 contract that it doubled the price from around $2 billion to nearly £4 billion. And it had increased the development time from an estimated 7 years to 18 years. And so those changes to the specification were responsible for those 14 deaths. And yet, even though Raymond Lygo had said on Radio 5, and it was reported elsewhere, that they regularly overcharged for these changes, profits depended on them, that was never mentioned by anybody, including Sir Charles Haddon Cave, in relation to the Nimrod crash.
How much money in your career that you've been watching this in total do you think is involved?
Well, my honest estimate would be it must run into the tens of billions of pounds. It's gone to various defence companies, most of which have been swallowed up by BAE Systems now. But, you know, the terrible thing is, for instance, with the fraud involving changes to the contract specification, most of that money actually doesn't go to anybody's benefit. It's just a complete waste. It doesn't even benefit the company that's carrying out the fraud, most of that money.
There's this whole revolving doors, isn't there, between defence contractors, directors of these firms, and also people who are supposed to be overseeing them in Parliament, even MPs, this kind of thing. Can you just give us an idea of how that works?
The campaign against the arms trade have highlighted this, that civil servants and government ministers and even political advisers to politicians tend to flip between working in the government and in the Ministry of Defence and working for the defence industry or for organisations which are funded by the defence industry, like think tanks. You know, the former Conservative minister and one-time leadership contender whose father came over here as a refugee from the Spanish Civil War, Michael Portillo, he was a defence minister and he was later put on the board of BAE Systems. After the Labour government came in, I remember reading that BAE Systems got rid of all their Conservative appointees and put some Labour people on the board instead. Because you obviously want to have people who have influence with the current government on your board. I mean, I did work in the industry for 20 years. I had friends in there, and I do agree I would not like to see the defence industry go down the drain. And if it was a matter of very small, isolated instances, I think with some credibility, I'll argue, right, let's sweep this under the carpet. We don't want to damage the reputation of the company. But this is massive. It's going on. Raymond Lygo said this is routine. It's that bad. It's routine. It's massive. It's costing us billions. It's damaging our national defence. And when it gets to that level, you've got to start prosecuting people.
One of the solutions to all this has been proffered over Christmas 2011 was that they're now taking steps to privatise the procurement process because they've recognised that there's too much fraud involved at the moment.
Yes, I have no faith in proposals that are being put forward by people who are probably on the take themselves. I do think one of the absolutely necessary changes that has to be made is that there have to be genuinely independent criminal investigations when there are allegations of fraud. And you have to put an end to the revolving door corruption at the Ministry of Defence, not just civil servants, but also government ministers and political advisers. And I don't see that on the horizon at all.
Can you give us any examples of the sort of contracts, the most recent sort of contracts, where you believe this fraud may be going on and any evidence that it might be?
The most recent named contract I can think of is the MRA4, which has now been scrapped. But I would say any contract which is going massively over budget because of changes to the specification, that should be setting off alarm bells. As long as people are prepared to break the law, and they can do it knowing that they'll never be prosecuted or even publicly outed, you know, this sort of stuff is going to continue.
You can't allow total public scrutiny of everything the defence industry does, can you?
Oh, absolutely not. But there is a difference between the things which really need to be kept secret and the things that are kept secret just because it's easier to keep everything secret than to really scrutinise what needs to be kept secret and what doesn't. The things that tend to get treated as the most secret are the things which shouldn't really be secret. They're just embarrassing. There needs to be genuinely independent and properly resourced criminal investigations. They need to put an end to revolving door corruption. If they did that, I think things would improve tremendously.
And do you think it would make a difference to the effectiveness and morale of our troops on the ground?
Well, I think it would do, yes, because they would be more likely to get the equipment that they order on time at the price that was agreed, and the equipment would be more reliable. The fact that less money was going on fraud meant there would be more money to employ service personnel and pay them decent wages and expenses. The information that's been published, I've had to publish myself on indie media because news organisations are just terrified that they'll be sued for defamation if they mention any of this stuff.
I think definitely they should be prosecuted if there's been fraud. But, I mean, the problem we've got here is why have we got private companies building arms at all? We used to have a nationalised arms industry. Basically, there's no profit to be made from a nationalised arms industry.
But just a minute, because all the way through the Second World War, there were private businesses making aircraft, and then eventually
they were all nationalised, and BAE Systems is the privatised fruit of all of that. I mean, look at the Swedish arms industry. It's all owned by the Swedish government, or it was at one time. I don't think there's any case whatsoever for building... I mean, it's not a free market. How can it be a free market? The Chinese can't bid to build our aircraft carriers, can they? They're the enemy. So there's no free market, and if there's no free market, there's no case for competition. You have a planned... And then everybody knows if we're spending X on military equipment, it's X. What they also get is people spending more on military equipment than they ought to because there's a vested interest pushing for more stuff to be made.
What about the culture, then, that comes after 20 years of systematic fraud where we're told that basically somebody bids for a contract at a very low price knowing that they can then change that contract halfway through in order to make their big profits?
Well, there's a lot about this in Andrew Feinstein's book, The Shadow World, the Inside the Arms Industry, and he was interviewed for this show a few weeks ago.
Yeah, so you can get that on our podcasts from just before Christmas, yeah.
Yes, and I have read the book, and basically armaments industries are the most corrupt. Apart from the banks, the arms industry is the most corrupt of all. So who's got all the money? It isn't the disabled people in REMPLOY, it's the banks and the arms companies. And who's that? The big shareholders, the money men.
Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way this week, because Friday night is music night. 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party, followed by the UFO show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Councillor for St George West and leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Peter Hammond. Also to David Powell from Friends of the Earth, and to old Labour Oxford economist you just heard there, Martin Summers. Next week, the Battle of Arnhem, a bridge not far. Yes, you heard me right. New revelations that prove Monty's Operation Market Garden in September 1944, aimed at severing the German supply lines on the Western Front, may have been sound. Problem was, the tanks of the Grenadier Guards took an estimated 18-hour tea break at Nijmegen. If they hadn't, war in Europe could have been brought to been over 6 months earlier, by Christmas 1944. And we'll also be having a special event at noon the day after at the Cut and Thrust War Game Centre on Old Market. Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org. thisweek.org.uk, or even easier, thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and our archives, where you'll find that show, an interview with Andrew Feinstein, who wrote the book The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade, which was out at the end of last year. I'm Tony Gosley, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Music this week from 1998, and it's Moose. This is that typical Heart FM song, but what Heart FM don't tell you is that you can hear the singers, Emma, Nadine and Inaya. They probably have the hots because they're ovulating. If you listen carefully, you can even hear their eggs shooting out of their fallopian tubes into their wombs, amazingly enough. Just one word of advice: to avoid heartache and diseases, sex should only take place in a loving relationship, preferably after marriage.